The next case is 06503, in re Cameron Foster. Mr. Price.
Chief Justice Moyer, may it please the court. My name is James Price. I'm an assistant county prosecutor and counsel for the appellant at the Cuyahoga County Department of Children and Family Services.
Would you pull that microphone closer to your mouth, please?
Thank you, Your Honor. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. This case arises out of a motion to modify temporary custody to permanent custody, which was filed pursuant to 2151-413 on October 2nd, 2003, at which time CF and SF had been in the agency's custody for approximately 1 year. There are two certified questions before the court. The first question is whether a reasonable efforts determination is required for motions for permanent custody filed pursuant to 2151-413. The second certified question is whether a trial court abuses its discretion by denying a request for an in-camera interview and a permanent custody determination when there's nothing in the record to indicate that having the children testify would have been detrimental to them or that they did not desire to testify. The appellant asserts that both of these questions have to be answered in the negative. The provisions regarding reasonable efforts findings are set forth in Ohio Revised Code Section 21-51-419. Pursuant to 419, at hearings held on complaints filed under Revised Code Section 2151-28.31E, .314, .33, and .353, the agency is required to make reasonable efforts. By its plain terms, Revised Code Section 2151-419 does not apply to motions for permanent custody brought pursuant to 2151-413, or to hearings held on permanent custody motions pursuant to 2151-414.
Counsel, the appellee argues that this is really a factual dispute, that the court made no such finding that the interviews must happen in all cases, just that they should have done one in this case on a factual abuse of discretion basis, and that they reviewed the plan and said the plan wasn't adequate for addressing the father's issues. What issue of law do we really have in this case that we need to resolve?
Your Honor, in that respect, what was before the court was a motion for permanent custody that was filed under 413. The agency, or the trial court, I'm sorry, made findings under 2151-414E that the children could not and should not be returned to the parents. It made three findings under E. The first one is under E1, the second was E2, the third was E4. Any one of those findings require the trial court to make a determination that the children cannot be returned to the parents. It went from there to determine the best interest of the children. The issue of law here, I know that the appellee has tried to construct the argument such that the court's finding under 2151-414E represented a reasonable efforts finding, and that's just simply not the case. Those are all optional findings that may be made by the court in determining whether the children can be returned to the parents. I don't know if that answers your question.
Not exactly, because it appears to be just an abuse of discretion finding that the Court of Appeals said, we just don't agree with the conclusions you made based on the evidence and reverse you on an abuse of discretion. And I'm having trouble struggling to see what case law we make out of this that would be different in other cases.
I understand, Your Honor. What the court actually said was that under the circumstances that a reasonable efforts finding that the court that it didn't believe that that the agency had made reasonable efforts.
That's a factual conclusion. That's the law. You make reasonable reasonable efforts. They just said you didn't make them. That's not a legal issue.
But it's not, but reasonable efforts are not required under a motion for permanent custody under 413. So if that is the court's finding in this respect, that's not a finding that bears any weight on a motion. Now, it would bear weight if we were in the past looking at a complaint under one of the sections that I named previously. But at this stage in the proceedings, after the children had already been in custody for a year, and a motion has been filed under 413, reasonable efforts are no longer required. And since they're no longer required, the court's finding, regardless of what it finds concerning reasonable efforts, would not bear on the final decision in the case.
So, counsel, the only time the court then, in your opinion, could survey the efforts made for reunification, the plans, the cooperation, the evidence, would be at a temporary custody extension hearing?
An extension hearing would be one case. 415 provides that you can extend, of course, temporary custody
for
6 months.
But
during that period, yes, reasonable efforts would still be required, as it says in 415.
Or if the parent would petition the court for a review because the agency was not making efforts, depending on what juncture you're at.
That would be during the pendency of the temporary custody period, that first year.
So say that there were not efforts being made and that was never reviewed by the court during the temporary, but we have a situation where the agency then moves for permanent custody. And you're saying that the court cannot do a look back at that period to see whether reasonable efforts for reunification planning had been made.
I believe that's what the statute provides, Your Honor. 2151.415 states that an agency may file for permanent custody after being granted temporary custody. The provision in 415 concerning review hearings or concerning extensions of temporary custody do make a provision to continue to look back at reasonable efforts.
Counsel, doesn't that mean then, in your answer to Justice O'Connor's question, that if the agency ignored the mandate of the statute to make reasonable efforts while the clock's running, if the clock runs out, they can benefit from their prior bad acts of refusing to undertake the reasonable efforts that the statute mandates?
Your Honor, that would be the case if the agency was not required to get reasonable efforts findings through the course of that temporary custody procedure. At the onset of custody, when the child is first taken out of the home, the first hearing, there has to be a reasonable efforts finding that the agency attempted to prevent the removal of that child from the home. The next reasonable efforts finding, as it was in this case, was made on January 7th during the adjudication and dispositional phase. At that time, the court found that the agency had made reasonable efforts during the predispositional temporary custody phase. The next reasonable efforts finding was made in April 7th. At that time, the court made a reasonable efforts finding that the agency was facilitating reunification.
If that had occurred, and as you say, and the finding was at each juncture by the court that reasonable efforts and the statute was complied with,
yes, Your Honor,
and the parents' attorney or the parents through counsel felt that wasn't the case, what's their recourse at that period?
It's to appeal the reasonable efforts finding within 14 days.
To the
court that has jurisdiction over the matter, to the court that made the finding. In this case, it would be juvenile court.
So it would be the magistrates making these findings. They appeal then to the trial court, or the judge.
Yes.
And then where do they go if the judge sustains the magistrate?
I would assume that they would go to the 8th district, but I'm
just not sure. Is that appealable at that point?
I'm not sure that that's an appealable issue. I'm sorry.
Well, okay, that's my point here. If at every juncture you're saying if they don't appeal it at that juncture and they get through the temporary period and then there's a move made for permanent custody, the trial court never has to look at what happened up to that point because presumably it passed muster all the way in the juvenile proceedings, the juvenile court.
Yes, and if it passed muster throughout the juvenile proceedings, there's no appeal filed, as there was no appeal filed as to the reasonable efforts finding in this case, then yes, it goes forward, and after a motion for permanent custody is filed, from that point forward, reasonable efforts are no longer required. Now, that's what the statute says. 2151.419 says that reasonable efforts are required at hearings on complaints filed pursuant to 2151.28, 31E, 314, 33, and 353. Does not include motions for permanent custody filed pursuant to 413.
And I understand that an attempt at reunification once permanent custody is requested is futile. There's no reason to plan for reunification
Cross
if
purposes.
The plan was to take the child and put it in the custody, permanent custody of the agency, and then plan for it afterwards in an adoptive setting or some other. But up to that point, it just seems to bother me that there can't be a review of the reasonable efforts made prior to the permanent, the reunification plan up to that point.
I understand, Your Honor. I believe what we're looking at here today specifically, though, is the authority of the court to make a finding after a motion for permanent custody is filed, according to the statute, the reasonable efforts findings at that point are immaterial.
Well, Mr. Price, in follow-up to Justice O'Connor, the Court of Appeals says in its opinion that the trial court abused discretion in finding that the agency used reasonable efforts to reunify the appellant with the children. The two plans were developed after the motion for permanent custody, and their conclusion was, while the appellant was attempting reunification, there was no case plan in effect for him, and therefore the reasonable case planning would have necessitated a plan during that unifying period.
Yes, sir.
That's the essence of the Court of Appeals opinion. I think that's why Justice Stratton says this is a really factual issue.
That is a factual issue. Actually, there was a case plan in place.
So
throughout the
factually, the Court
case.
Of Appeals missed it. Is that what
they
you're
did.
Arguing?
They did. That's true. But I believe that's a subsidiary issue here.
Because you're saying reasonable efforts aren't required.
They're not required.
Permanent custody has been
permanent
established.
We filed a motion for permanent custody.
So that's the legal issue that you want us
that's
to address.
That's the legal issue that we need to address here. With regard to the second issue, if you don't have any other questions regarding the first, Your Honor.
I still have a question. Are you conflating the two? Simply because something's not required, you're suggesting that it's prohibited. In other words, because the reasonable effort finding is not mentioned in that particular section, that the court is prohibited from delving into it at all?
No, Your Honor, because 419 does set the parameters for reasonable efforts findings. Furthermore, this court has actually, in NRACW in 2004, 2004 set out the requirements for permanent custody. And there's two prongs for permanent custody on a motion. The first requires that the court find that a child is orphaned or abandoned or has been in the agency's custody for 12 or more months of a consecutive 22-month period, or that the child cannot and should not be returned to the parents. After it makes a finding in that respect, it has to go and make a finding whether permanent custody is in the best interest of the child.
Did the court make a 22-month finding?
Your Honor, no, not pursuant to 414E. Now, the children were in custody for a year.
Did the court specifically find that exact finding, that the children had been in the custody for 12 of 22 months in its conclusions of law?
Yes. Yes, the court made that finding. It did make that finding. And it also made findings under 414E1, E2, and E4. And also it mentioned that the father had not visited the children in over 90 days. So there were a number of findings under E that would support 2151-414B1A. So does that answer your question, Your Honor? As far as the requirements for permanent custody, they're set out, okay?
The best interests of the child seems to still be an elastic concept. You don't think that the issue of reasonable efforts might somehow come into that particular issue, that still is within the authority of the court to look at under that section?
With regard to the best interest of the child, those factors are subsumed under 2151-414D, and there are five factors there. First is interrelationship of the child with family members, siblings, etc. And the second is an issue that we have here today is the child's wishes as expressed by the child or the guardian ad litem with regard for the maturity of the child.
You have used your time, Mr. Price.
Time is up, Your Honor.
Red light is on.
Okay. Sorry. Yes. I guess I'll conclude here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Sweeney.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Colin Sweeney. I'm an assistant public defender, and I'm here representing the appellee, Wayne Foster, who's with us today. I'd like to, we filed a motion, and I plan to share 5 minutes with amicus counsel, Kate Federley, and I will be keeping that in mind in my discussion. Though I'm prepared to answer any of the questions, of course, that this court has, I intend to focus my time discussing the issues first of whether or not a conflict of law actually exists in either of the certified questions, and then focusing on the merits of the first issue and leave the merits of the second issue to amicus counsel. Our position is essentially threefold. In this case, we believe that having had the benefit of full briefing in this case, it's apparent that there is not indeed a conflict of law with respect to either certified question. Secondly, if this court were to find there were a conflict and reach the merits of this case, we believe that the Eighth District correctly decided both issues. And finally, even if this court were to disagree with our position and the position of the Eighth District, this case should the underlying case would still need to be affirmed because this is, of course, a case here just on a certified conflict. There was no discretionary appeal taken in this case. And there's a third holding by the Eighth District, which is that the best interest determination was an error. That finding has never been challenged by the appellant and would stand regardless of how this court resolves the certified questions in this case. With respect to the first
What would that ultimately mean to the status of the children?
Well, what would it ultimately mean is this case would go back to the juvenile court and basically be starting over. It would depend on what the DCFS decides to do with the case. I imagine they'd have to finally develop a case plan that would encompass my client, make reasonable efforts at reunifying him with his children, which they had not done in this case. And then if those efforts were successful, the children would be reunified with my client, and if not, they could take other measures.
Throughout this process, the children have remained in the same foster care?
As I understand, that's true.
And visitation continues?
The visitation continues every 2 weeks, is all that's been allowed Mr. Foster to date.
What is your strongest, I've just read the briefs, what is your strongest argument on the statutory interpretation issue that faces us? Not the policy, a lot of policy issues here, but this is a statutory interpretation case. What is your strongest argument on statutory interpretation?
With respect to the first certified question,
yes,
Your Honor?
Yes.
I believe our strongest argument actually is that this court has, in effect, in one respect, already decided this issue. In a bench notes that were provided, developed by this court and also developed by the Department of Jobs and Family Services that were provided to every juvenile court judge throughout the state and also to every magistrate in juvenile court, this court specifically indicated, or these bench notes specifically indicate more accurately, that reasonable efforts findings apply to permanent custody hearings, citing 2151.419, also Juvenile Rule 27B1, which should be noted is more broadly worded than the statute itself, 2151.419. So initially, I think that that's an important thing to point out. Moreover, I think that the way that the issue has been framed is very broad, whether reasonable efforts are required in permanent custody hearings. The way that the appellant has chosen to address the issue is very narrow, looking simply at this specific statute, 2151.419, and not considering the larger context of Chapter 2151. There are several provisions in addition to 2151.419 which require something akin to or identical to reasonable efforts. For instance, 2151.51, which sets forth the overriding policy and purposes of the chapter, provides that children should only be removed from their parents as a last resort, only when it's in the best interest of the children and only when necessary. We would submit that in order to be consistent with that policy purpose, that where a parent is ready, willing, and able, and indeed identified by DCFS as a potential, as reunification is a possibility, that the only way to fulfill that purpose is to make efforts to actually reunify the parent with their child. Moreover, the statute 2151.412 provides and requires the development of a case plan for every circumstance, outlining the permanency goal. In this case, it was reunification with the parent, both parents initially, and then setting forth steps and things that the agency will do to assist with that reunification. In this case, it's not correct that my client was covered by a case plan prior to the motion for permanent custody. There was a case plan that was developed at the outset of this case before my client even had notice of what was going on, before he had an attorney, and before he was participating in the development of the case plan. And this particular case plan focused on Deborah Foster, Mr. Foster's ex-wife, and eventually the magistrate judge specifically exempted him from participation in the case plan. No referrals for any services were made based on this case plan, and he was exempted from it.
At that point, was there the representation made, though, that he was physically unable to care for the children?
There was, before he was involved in the case, I mean, originally the way this case started is Mrs. Foster kidnapped the children from Nevada, brought them back to Cleveland.
Right, and then Mrs. Foster's out of the picture and she voluntarily relinquished the children for permanent custody.
Correct.
So we're only focusing on your client.
I understand.
And initially, he could not physically take care of the children, and that was stipulated.
Well, initially, the way that that arose, it was an allegation made by Deborah Foster before he was even involved in the case, before he had notice of the complaint. She was the one that had made that allegation, and that's clear in the transcript. The social worker in this case made clear that that information came from his wife and was never investigated by DCFS. Ultimately, my client, Wayne Foster, was the one who brought this to light. The reference to a stipulation is, before my client was represented by counsel, he came in finally, once he received notice, came in for a hearing, and there was a complaint, which he did sign, finally, which included, and it said that he was terminally ill with cirrhosis of the liver. He never indicated to them that that was indeed the case, And in fact, he was the one that clarified that he was not indeed ill. And so I think that the important thing is that with this case, that getting away from whether reasonable efforts were made, the question, obviously, this court has to decide is whether they need to be made. And the appellant spent some time talking about these preliminary findings that are required under .419.
Counsel, can I clarify something?
Yes.
You're advocating that the Court of Appeals decision be upheld. On page 3, it says, on January 7, 2003, trial was held on the neglect complaint. Appellant stipulated that he was terminally ill, with cirrhosis of the liver and is unable to provide physical care for the children, but provides financial support. Is that accurate or inaccurate in the Court of Appeals decision?
The Court of Appeals decision accurate. I mean, what I was trying to explain is that the stipulation occurred when he was unrepresented by counsel and he simply signed the complaint form that DCFS initiated. He was the one that made clear that that these allegations were indeed not true once he fully understood that the scope of the allegations that had been made by his ex-wife. The appellant makes a point to say that reasonable efforts are only required up until the point of temporary custody. And they highlight that reasonable efforts findings have been made consistent with the statute, 2151.419. But really, if you look underneath that bare assertion, you'll find that this is really just a check mark that the juvenile court judge makes in every case. These findings are not subject to, they don't take evidence on it. They certainly don't present clear and convincing evidence that reasonable efforts are made. And my client, with respect to the first two reasonable efforts findings, was not even present for those hearings. The first one on October 9th, he wasn't present. The second one on January 7th, the reasonable efforts finding only applied to the mother. The third one, at a time when the father still did not have counsel in this case, the reasonable efforts also only applied to the mother.
But you do agree, don't you, that 419 does not expressly refer to permanent custody. You have to really backfill to get there, do you not?
I don't believe so, because, I mean, our position is that what the 8th District decided, and this is why there's no conflict in this case, the 8th District looked at one of the findings that's required to grant permanent custody, 2151.414E1, and found that the trial court's conclusion that reasonable case planning and diligent efforts at reunification were made was in error. And so they relied specifically on that statute. I mean, I think if you look, I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, but I just want to emphasize that the Court of Appeals did not rely on 419, and that's why there's no
conflict. That's the amicus's problem with the Court of Appeals opinion. They say this is should be a 419 case, or they should have, but they didn't.
But they didn't. And I do think that the important thing to look at is that that it's required, whether or not 419 says it, reasonable efforts emanates and pervades the statute. Indeed, I think you also have to consider the fact that there's constitutional rights in the care and custody of a child, which are implicated in this case, to permit an agency to terminate, permanently sever, the rights of a parent and their children without giving them the opportunity to work towards reunification by providing reasonable efforts would violate his constitutional rights. Indeed,
why doesn't the best interest element of the test, why doesn't that subsume all of this? Best interest of the child, I mean, should include, I would think, whether the child can be returned to the parents.
Your Honor, I do think that it does. I think that's one other place in the statute that provides that reasonable efforts requirement that actually be made in a part of ensuring that the best interest of the children are respected. And so I do think that's an additional source for this requirement. I think that's correct. I do want to defer the rest of the time, but I do want to highlight just one last thing with respect to the second certified question, and that's that it really is a factual determination. That in this case, every court that's addressed the question of in-camera hearing has said abuse of discretion is the standard of review. What we have here is an 8th District opinion which looked at specific facts that are to this case that are not present in any of the cases cited by the state. And said, you know what, in this particular circumstance, this is an abuse of discretion. They didn't establish a broad rule of law that is in conflict with these other instances. And for that reason.
Counsel, before you sit down, if I understand procedurally what happened here, the agency did file for permanent custody, and it was almost like a threat hanging over the head of the appellee here, and then reunification activity and planning was taking place all the time this was pending at the juvenile court. And it's almost as though they were giving him a second, third, maybe fourth chance, that while this is pending, here's what you have to do, and if you're successful in this reunification planning, then chances are we'll withdraw the motion for permanent custody and reunification can take place. So to me, we're more just looking at a specific case where procedurally the motion for permanent custody and the reunification plan are coexisting. Is that accurate?
I would say it's not quite accurate, because I think that what happened in this case really is this would really be his first chance. They made no efforts until the time with respect to case planning for Mr. Foster until they moved for permanent custody. I don't believe that even if he had met every criteria of that case plan, that they would have reunified.
You don't know that.
I don't know that. What I'm saying is that they had made their permanency goal permanent custody at that point in time. And I think at that point in time,
they were not mandated to proceed along that course of conduct. They could have withdrawn their application for permanent custody had the reunification plan been successful.
I think that's true. They certainly have the discretion to withdraw it. That's true, Your Honor.
Counsel, do you agree that the court made two D findings, D3 and D4 both?
I do agree with, are you saying E2?
No, I'm saying D. Best interest determination, D3 and D4, 12 of 22, and the child's need for a legally secure permanent placement, and whether that type of placement can be achieved without a grant of permanent custody to the agency. Did the court make both of those findings?
I agree that they made that finding. What I'd say is that this isn't a 12 of 22 case, because the children were not indeed in custody. It's not a 12 of 22 case in the sense that that absolves them from making the findings that the kids could not or should not be placed with the parents, because they were indeed not in custody for 12 of 22 months, and the social worker in this case admitted as much in her affidavit in the original motion for permanent custody. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sweeney. Ms. Federley. You can start with your counsel has used your time, but with our help, so just take a minute to start.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, my name is Kate Federley, and I, along with co-counsel Jason Mackey, represent Amicus Curiae, the Justice for Children Project. I first want to note that the failure to make reasonable efforts is not going to be excused by the simple expedient of filing a permanent custody motion. When Congress adopted the Adoption and Safe Families Act in 1997, Congress explicitly identified certain circumstances under which the state agency seeking removal need not make reasonable efforts. Nevertheless, Congress did retain the reasonable efforts requirement in all other circumstances. Moreover, federal funding for foster care and adoption assistance is contingent on the state actually making reasonable efforts when it's required to do so. Those reasonable efforts are excused only under certain narrowly drawn exceptions, which include the identification of certain crimes committed by the parent, the involuntary termination of parental rights as to another child, or the parent has subjected the subject child to aggravated circumstances.
Counsel, could I ask, are reasonable efforts located solely in Section 0.419?
No, they're not.
Or do they pervade other parts of the chapter?
Yes, they do, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Ohio amended its own statutory scheme in 1998 to bring Ohio law into compliance with the federal law. Clearly, it would defeat the purpose of those amendments to now read 2151.413 as dispensing entirely with the reasonable efforts requirement. It would also subject Ohio to the loss of federal funding. I would note, of course, that any reasonable efforts determination made by the trial court is not a final appealable order. Therefore, there would be no recourse for a parent who wishes to challenge that reasonable efforts finding until there would be an opportunity to appeal the case.
Then the permanent custody hearing is the venue.
That would be correct.
That needs to take place before the reasonable effort criteria can be challenged?
Your Honor, when the permanent custody hearing is held, reasonable efforts have to be established by the state. If there is a finding,
so that's appropriate subject matter for review by the court and a finding at the permanent custody hearing?
Correct.
Contrary to what opposing counsel says?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Do you agree that this is really more of an abuse of discretion issue? The court, in your opinion, properly followed the law in this case, and we're looking at really, not the trial court, the court of appeals properly followed the law, and we're looking at an abuse of discretion in the reversal. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor. I do not believe that there is at all any conflict between the circuits. They're all applying the same legal standard here. What's actually happened is really this has become in many ways a direct appeal, but the court need not address these underlying issues if the court finds that this matter was improvidently granted as to both issues. I would also note, Your Honor, that best interest is certainly part and parcel of the findings that need to be made here. However, that best interest determination cannot be made first. There has to be some finding of parental unfitness or inability that would terminate parental rights before we then move on to a best interest finding. Otherwise, everyone's children might well be subject to removal, since I suppose it's always possible to find a better placement for any child that appears in front of a court. As to the in-camera interview, again, it is our position that this matter was improvidently granted, since the four cases cited by appellant are actually all cases applying the same legal standard, that is abuse of discretion.
Counsel, excuse me, but in re CW, the case that we decided in 2004,
yes,
talked about the motion for permanent custody. We didn't get into the reasonable efforts issue at all. Are you stating that that decision ought to be looked at again if we were to take this case on the merits?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, that you need to revisit CW given the decision that was made. However, I do think that any time a permanent custody motion is pending before a trial court, that there has to be a showing of reasonable efforts prior to that filing of the motion. 419 actually says that the state may not file a permanent custody motion unless it has made reasonable efforts. So under those circumstances, if the court does believe that CW has failed to adequately address that question, then the court would have to come back and revisit CW.
Let me ask you about the certified. I'm a little confused about whether there's a certified conflict here. The question is, as you know, whether a reasonable efforts determination is required in motions for permanent custody filed pursuant to 251.413, are you saying that the other courts, the other courts of appeals have decided their cases on that legal issue, that there have not been reasonable efforts made in those cases, so there's no conflict with them?
Your Honor, my understanding of those cases is that they turn heavily on the factual aspects of each case. There doesn't appear to be a conflict here. Nevertheless, if this court does find that there is a conflict as to the first question, it is very clear that reasonable efforts are required and that merely filing a motion for permanent custody would not eliminate the need for reasonable efforts. I would agree with the court that 419 could be more artfully drafted. Nevertheless, given the entire statutory scheme and its grounding in federal law, it would be imperative to read these reasonable efforts requirements.
Well, I guess you seem to be arguing that because you agree with the Court of Appeals, there's no conflict, but I'm still wondering, that's a legal question. I mean, the way it's stated, it's a legal question whether a trial court has to, in a permanent custody determination, must make this reasonable efforts determination, and that's a legal question, is it not? And then you go to the next step, did they abuse their discretion in the way they did that? But that's, we have to say, I think, to the Court of Appeals, if there's a conflict, what they must do, whether they do have to make a reasonable efforts determination, or that's whether the agency has to make it or not. On that issue, is there not a conflict?
Your Honor, perhaps I should make myself clear. In my view, as to the in-camera interview question, there is an abuse of discretion standard
that,
required.
That one, that's different. Yeah, I
correct. Yeah. So if I have misled the court, I apologize. As to this other question, though, about whether there is a conflict as to the first issue, again, the question is whether or not reasonable efforts findings do need to be made in a permanent custody commitment. To the extent that this court is reading those lower cases to say that you can do away entirely with the reasonable efforts finding, then this court is correct. That would be problematic, and this court should step in to correct that misapprehension of the Courts of Appeal.
Do you read the conflict cases as saying they don't have to have reasonable efforts?
I was not reading them that way, Your Honor, but I can certainly understand why another.
That's why you're saying there's no conflict, because you don't think the cases stand for
I do not
the opposite position.
That is correct, Your Honor. In sum, it seems fairly clear then that 419 reasonable efforts are required in all cases, even at the permanent custody stage. Moreover, it's extremely important to note that children are parties to these matters. The court made that decision in In re Williams. Consequently, because children are parties to these cases, they do have a right to be heard. Absent any clear and unequivocal statement from the child that the child does not wish to participate, it would be an abuse of discretion for the court to fail to conduct an in-camera interview. Again, that is if the court finds that there is a conflict on this particular issue. Certainly the statement...
Sum up.
Certainly. In sum, Your Honor, it is clear to us that the Court of Appeals got this case right. We would ask that the court dismiss the appeal for being improvidently granted, but if this court chooses to resolve the two matters on the substance, we would ask that this court find that there is a reasonable efforts finding that's required to be made under 419, and that it would be an abuse of discretion to fail to interview the children in camera without that clear and unequivocal statement of their wishes to fail to participate. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Faderly. Mr. Price, you've used your time, but start with a minute. We've given.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did want to clear up, Justice O'Connor, with regard to the appealing the reasonable efforts findings. Those reasonable efforts findings are appealable, and also the temporary custody hearing, the adjudication and disposition for temporary custody, that's also a final appealable order. So this could have been appealed at that stage as well. So it's not that the appellee did not have redress in that respect.
So at every juncture, if there's a review then capable of the reunification plan at each hearing and the temporary custody, you're saying then that the court reviewing a permanent custody can take notice of the reasonableness that was found at each juncture but cannot alter those findings?
Because that would be res judicata.
Okay, if they're not.
That's right.
All right, I understand. Right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.